Us and Them is sponsored by the Charleston Gazette-Mail, the largest newspaper in the state of West Virginia, featuring two editorial pages expressing both progressive and conservative views. Find it online at wvgazettemail.com. We intended to be on break right now, but we wanted to shine our light on some fantastic reporting on the exodus of people fleeing war-torn Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and other countries, and seeking refuge in Europe. Over the past few months, Scott Carrier has been reporting on the crisis for his podcast, Home of the Brave. If you don't know Scott's work, he's an author and an award-winning radio journalist. He got his start by buying a tape recorder, walking to the highway in Salt Lake City, Idaho, and sticking out his thumb. He hitchhiked across the country and interviewed anyone who picked him up. He eventually made it to the National Public Radio offices in Washington, D.C., and asked people there if they could help him transform these hitchhiker interviews into radio. From West Virginia Public Broadcasting, this is Us and Them. It's the podcast where we tell stories from America's cultural divides. I'm Trey Kay. Scott Carrier has a unique storytelling style. If you're a fan of This American Life, he's been one of their featured contributors for decades. His pieces combine sensitive interviews of regular folks with deep, thought-provoking insights on what he observes. If it isn't obvious already, Scott is a hero of mine. He's a major influence for why I do what I do, and particularly for the Us and Them podcast. So for today's episode of Us and Them, we are featuring one of Scott Carrier's Home of the Brave podcasts, The Balkan Route. Let's listen to this piece, and then we'll pick up with Scott on the other end.
Welcome to Home of the Brave. I'm Scott Carrier. You may have seen some photos of large groups of refugees, like 200 men, women, and children walking across the countryside of Europe through farm fields, something reminiscent of the Second World War. Actually, they only have to walk across the borders, 1 to 2 kilometers, then they get on buses and trains that take them to the next border, where they get off and walk across to more buses and trains, country to country, from Greece to Germany. This man has just crossed the border from Greece into Macedonia, and we're walking on a dirt road between farm fields, the sky overcast and gray, the soil turned over for winter.
Excuse me, hey. Do you know where is the bus?
Yes, I know where the bus is.
Yes, where is, can you show us the way?
Yes, everybody's going to the bus now.
Yeah.
So it's okay, you'll be okay. Okay. Where are you from?
I'm from Syria.
And you're with, who are you
with? My wife.
And children, or just
No,
your
I don't
wife?
Have children.
And what did you do in Syria?
I was teacher, English teacher.
Really?
Yes.
Why did you leave home?
Because everything is destroyed.
Huh. And what's your name?
Huh?
What is your name?
My name is Shero.
Shero. And you say everything was destroyed. Could you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, but because you know the situation in our country, you know, this kind of the people is horrible. ISIS.
What kinds of things do they do?
They kill the women, animals, rocks, trees, everything.
They kill the...
Everything.
In what town were you living?
I'm living in Qamishli.
Qamishli. And where is that?
The north in Syria.
Right.
Near Turkey border.
And how did you walk from... Syria into Turkey?
Yes, I went, I take the mountains, I walk like four days, and I pass the border to Turkey. After that, I came to Greek. I take the board, but our board is fall down in the water. 15 packs is died, passed away. My aunt, my everywhere. 10 children. And 5 women, all of them has passed away, all of them died in the sea. No one, we tried to call the Turkish government.
Coast Guard?
Yes, he refused to help us. And we tried to call the Greek police, no one helped us. Only we saw some fishes.
Fishes?
Yeah.
Fishermen?
Yeah, fishermen.
In a boat?
With a boat. And try to pick up from the water.
And they did?
Yes, they did.
They rescued you?
I so proud, and I so lucky because I meet some, the people have white heart. Still the life, I think you can live.
Huh. They have a white heart. What does that mean?
It's innocent good, people.
Innocent people.
Yeah. Huh.
So where do you want to go now?
I want to go to you, to Germany. Maybe I find peace there.
In Germany?
Yeah. Because only the Germany is opened her border for us.
At the end of August of this year, 2015, Angela Merkel announced that Germany would accept refugees with open arms, that is, if they could get there. In 2 weeks, by the middle of September, there were 6,000 refugees a day arriving in Athens by ferry, many with only the clothes on their back and a cell phone, speaking Arabic and Persian languages, not knowing where they're going to eat or sleep, let alone how they're going to travel 1,242 miles across six countries to get to the border of Germany. The Balkan route is like a pipeline built in short order to move all these people north. I call it a pipeline, even though the refugees are transported in buses and trains, because it's a contained route, keeping everybody together by crossing the borders at remote stations set up especially for refugees. Nobody wandering off the trail or leaking out into places where they're not wanted, like Macedonia, Serbia, Croatia, and Slovenia. The Balkan route is the way through these Balkan states into Austria and then Germany. I don't know what the trip was like for the refugees through most of the Balkan states because the route was so contained by police that they could keep reporters out if they wanted to, and they did. We were denied access to refugees in most of Macedonia, all of Serbia and Croatia, and most of Slovenia. But I heard accounts of this part of the trip from refugees after they made it through, and their descriptions made it sound like a cattle drive, where police in riot gear yelled at them, pushing them through corridors of razor wire fences and onto overcrowded trains. We were, however, allowed to talk to refugees in northern Slovenia at a transit camp on the Austrian border, where things were fairly civil. The camp was guarded by police in riot gear, but the management inside the camp was organized by the civil guard, like our National Guard, focused on humanitarian efforts and logistics. The refugees here are hungry and need to eat. Most of them are tired, exhausted, maybe traumatized by what happened to them back home.
How do you speak English?
Yeah.
What's your name?
Sufyan.
And, where
Iraq.
And what town?
Mosul.
You
this is my brother.
Your brothers?
Yeah.
When did you leave Mosul?
The Mosul leave the Syria because no can go on outside because of the Daesh. You have the night time, you going for not no one guy see you, you going from night time, whole family, you keep it everything. No can bring everything with you. If catch you Daesh, he kill you.
What like do you have? What did you bring with you?
Nothing. Just clothes? Just the clothes coming out. And if some money have my home, bring it with you. No, anything. My car, my house, all you where to live. No can bring anything.
Did you sell everything in Mosul?
No can sell because Daesh no law. Daesh, if you know, he come and catch you. See why you selling? Catch you. You know you have to go outside the Iraq, outside the Mosul.
So no how many are with your group? There's your two brothers.
I two brother, no four brother. My wife for my brother and my kid.
Huh. And how did you have? So you got in your car at night and drove out of Mosul.
No, the Mosul going to Syria like 4 hours walking.
Walking.
Yeah, walking 4 hours from Syria, Turkey, 10 hours.
So you walked at night.
Yeah, night time. No can. If going the morning time. You see you Daesh, kill you. Huh. No can.
So all of you, like, how many people total walking?
Like 20, 25 guys.
Walking at night, night into night. Syria.
Just the money. You take the money. Some guys have taken money. Huh. If I go from Mosul to Syria, you take the money. Like one guy's 500. From Syria, Turkey, take 1,000. From Turkey, and come in the Yunnan, you take one pencil, 1,000. Huh. All you just money.
For each person?
Yeah, each person.
How much has it cost so far? How much money have you spent to get here?
For now, I bring with me like 20,000. Just now, we now have just 1,000. All losing.
20,000.
Yeah.
This man says we have to go now, so thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. You are welcome. Good luck, you guys.
Okay.
You are welcome.
My name is Ala Davis.
And you're from Syria?
Yes.
Where in Syria are you from?
From Dar'a city. Dar'a city.
Dar'a. And why did you leave your home?
Because my home is a war now. There is a war in my home, and there is no space to me.
Were they fighting in your city, in Dar'a?
Yes, in my city, yes. And my home was destroyed, and there is no home for me.
Your home was destroyed?
Yes.
By a bomb?
From helicopter.
From a helicopter?
Yes.
They dropped a bomb?
Yes.
The Syrian army?
The Syrian army, government. Yes.
Why did they drop a bomb on your home?
They drop a bomb in any civilians, in anything move, he's will killed. Anything move, human, animal, anything, we will killed.
Were you fighting the government?
No.
In war against the government?
No, I'm just civilians, I'm students.
You're a student?
Yes, and my father died. Dying, shot him.
Who
the
shot?
Government.
The government
the
shot
army.
Your father.
Yes, shot
why,
my
why
father.
Why did he shoot your father?
I don't know. He shot him front the door in my house because we need freedom, and the freedom, the meaning of freedom, he is Bashar Assad go. Okay, Bashar Assad. If he is still in the Syria, there is no freedom. No. He's kill us.
My name is Abdul Majid.
And you're from Syria?
Yes.
Damascus?
No, Homs.
Homs?
Yes.
And why did you leave Homs?
Because in Homs there is many different soldiers. There is Nusra and EIS and the normal soldier, Syrian soldier. So that's why I don't want to fight with anybody. I don't want to fight with Assad, and I don't want to fight with the EIS. In my city, there is EIS yet now, in the moment.
Islamic State. That's maybe it's better out here. It's too noisy there. Okay, so...
EIS, you know EIS? Daesh.
Daesh, yeah, we call it the ISIS.
ISIS.
Yeah.
In my home, there is one family from Chechenian.
Chechenian, where's that?
It's in Russian. Chechen.
Chechen, right.
There is one family, they take it my house.
They moved into your house?
Yes.
And did they come and kick you out, or were you gone? Was the house empty when they came?
No, when we go out, the house is empty. So they come, they open the door, didn't. But I asked my uncle, he's there. He told me, your house now, it's with one family from Chechen. And my uncle, he told the family, why you come here? They say it, we have a right to stay here, we fight with Syrian people. And we will stay here.
Wow. So it's a whole family from Chechnya.
It's 3 or 4 person. Yes. It's unbelievable in Syria. You know, if it is in 10 years or 20 years, we lose it Syria, it's okay. But it's in 2 years or few minutes. Everything happened. It's
very
in
quickly.
Minutes. Huh. It's unbelievable. You cannot... We sleep when we open the eyes. It's like a dream. Because before I work, before I have it food, before I have a good house. And now it's everything finished. It's like a dream. Believe me, every day I say it, maybe today I wake up.
When the refugees arrive in Austria, German efficiency begins to kick in. The one steady flow of refugees is evenly diverted into 5 separate streams and bus to 5 separate camps in cities just over the border in Germany. And from there, they are sent to towns and cities scattered around the country. We went to the camp in Passau on the Danube River. The camp was unusual in that it was located right in the city, next to the train station, and there were no razor wire fences. The police were unarmed and friendly. Yes, I would even say the police were pleasant and eager to help. The camp had showers with hot water. Inside the big tent, there were children's drawings hanging on the wall. A duck, a flower, the words freedom and I love you, and stop killing Hazara and Quetta. At this camp, it was clear that an attempt was being made to show the refugees they were safe. They'd made it to Germany, where they'd be treated as human beings, and you could feel their sense of relief.
My name is Amir Muradi. I'm from Baghlan. Baghlan from Afghanistan.
And is in your town, are there Taliban in your town?
Yeah. Our town is in area of Taliban, like Kunduz. My town Kunduz, near Baghlan. To Kunduz.
Oh. So they came in like 2 months ago?
Yeah.
The Taliban, was it 2 months ago?
Before two months. Yeah.
And they came in shooting?
They came shooting. They who work in police, they shoot them. Work in politics, like...
They shot the government people?
Yeah, government people, they shoot them.
They shot them?
Yeah, they shot them. And they also destroy our schools.
Really?
They said, don't learn English, don't assist with American.
So what do you want to do? Do you want to keep going to school here in Germany?
Yeah, we love school.
So how old are you, 18?
Yeah. Oh, 18.
I'm 18 too.
This is 17.
So you want to go to school?
Yeah, we want to go to school. This place is so awesome.
Awesome.
Yeah, I love Germany. Without any joke. I love it. Yeah. We want to work hard.
What do you want to study?
Pharmacy, I like it. Journalist, like you, yeah. I like it.
All right.
And like, I'm a singer. Yeah, I can sing. Biyoke dil basao doye tu dadam Kadam bakad bo loye tu dadam Nadarad in jahan tobe ghame tu Nadarad in jahan to beghame tu Man umram ra bagham hae tu dadam Man umram ra bagham hae tu dadam Dar in zamana khuda medana Aashiqi mimana wo aashiq na mimana La lay lay la la lay lay La la lay la la lay lay La la lay la la lay lay La la lay la la lay
From each of these five camps along the border, a bus leaves every hour, carrying 50 refugees to their new homes in cities and towns scattered evenly around the country. If you do the math, that's 6,000 a day. In this way, over the course of the year, 2015, Germany accepted 800,000 refugees. I don't know what it's like in the towns and cities where they end up. I heard they live in ad hoc dormitories, in indoor stadiums, and large empty buildings. I met a Syrian in Hamburg who was living in a camp inside a shipping container. I read an article about Germans with extra space who let refugees stay in their homes. They all have to apply for asylum and then wait to see if they get it, which can take a long time. And if they don't get it, they're supposed to be deported. And if they do get it, they'll need to figure out how to become part of German society, which seems like it would be very difficult. I don't think the Germans even know how it'll turn out. The refugees keep coming, 4,000 a day through December, but Angela Merkel remains committed in her resolve. We'll figure it out, she said, and I hope they do. It would be good if Germany can figure out how to accept refugees and then show everybody else how to do it, because I think there are more refugee crises to come.
That was Scott Carrier's report, The Balkan Route, for his podcast, Home of the Brave. Coming up, I'll speak with Scott about what he saw and who he met among the stream of refugees. I'm Trey Kay, and this is Us and Them, which is supported in part by a grant from the Daywood Foundation. We've been listening to one of the five episodes of the Home of the Brave podcast, where journalist Scott Carrier follows the path of refugees fleeing warring countries in the Middle East and seeking refuge in Europe. Recently, I had the chance to speak with Scott about his experience of interviewing these refugees. So to people listening who don't know your work, Would you just say a little bit about how you came to the journalism you do?
Well, I think of it as anthropology, cultural studies sort of thing. And I didn't start by thinking of myself as a journalist, or even I don't really think of myself as a journalist now. Sometimes I report, but in my mind what I'm doing is more like cultural anthropology.
So why is it that you went to Europe to report on the refugees that are coming out of the Middle East?
I was invited to a film conference in Copenhagen to speak about podcasting. And when I was there, walking through the train station, I ran into some people who were refugees, and I started talking to them, and I started talking to people in Denmark about the refugee situation. And I thought, well, I've been following it from home before I went to the film conference, but when I got there, I thought I'd really like to hear the refugees speak, because the stories that I've been seeing and reading and watching, I didn't really hear anything from the refugees themselves. So the idea was to interview them. First, I wanted basically to know why they left home.
Right.
And then also I wanted to figure out how they got from their homes to Germany or Sweden or the places where they ended up in Europe. I kind of wanted to follow their trail or their path.
Why did you think asking these questions would matter to your audience on Home of the Brave?
Well, it just seems like a mistake that nobody was talking to the refugees. Why not talk to the refugees? And I wasn't hearing it. Most of the people I know, I asked them, do you ever hear interviews with the refugees? And it's like very seldom do you actually hear them speak. And so it just seemed like something that was being missed. It was kind of an obvious thing.
So tell me about the journey. So you're in Copenhagen, and how exactly did you go along the journey to meet up with these refugees and kind of follow their path?
Well, actually, nobody was trying to stay in Denmark. They were passing through Copenhagen, the train station, on the way to Sweden. When I first got there, Sweden was still accepting refugees. And so the idea was just to ask them, well, where were you before you came here? And then to trace the trail backwards.
So eventually you're heading towards...
Lesbos.
Yeah, Lesbos, and where people are coming across from Turkey.
Right.
And you basically have come from where these refugees, or many of them, are going to, right?
Right. Yeah, it was a strange... I mean, I guess it's just the way it worked out. And I think it worked out well in the end.
Because one of the things in I think the second or third installment, you have this scene that you describe where these people are asking you what it is that they're going to.
Right.
And you have this kind of tough job of kind of explaining that it may be kind of okay for some of them, but it's going to be really rough or incredibly disappointing to others.
Yeah, because we just come from a camp on the border of Macedonia and Greece where they were not letting people through who were not from Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. So if you're from Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria, you could keep going. Anybody else had to go back. So I had to tell them that, even though there were some Iranians on the ship, ferry boat. And I told them, and one of the guys said, no, I have a friend there. He said, we can go. They changed today. So, but it was unusual in that they were asking me what it was like, what was going to happen to them, because we'd already been where they were going, Camilla Mattson and myself, driving down.
Danish journalist and photographer Camilla Mattson accompanied Scott Carrier on this trip and conducts some of the interviews featured in this series. If you visit the Home of the Brave website, which is at homebrave.com, you can see some of Camilla's photos of the refugees' experiences. Do you know about that Iranian guy? Do you know if he got through at Macedonia?
No, no idea. So many people we met along the way, I have no idea what happened to them. Yeah, it's a strange place because somewhere between 700,000, maybe a million people have come across not just that channel, but other channels from Turkey to various Greek islands just this year on these little rubber dinghies. They're like Zodiacs, but not as good. And it's very dangerous, and it's kind of ridiculous and surreal because everybody knows it's happening. Turkey knows it's happening, and they allow it. I mean, they could stop it with helicopters and a few patrol boats. They could stop it if they want, but they don't. And so, you know, they allow these people to be smuggled. It's very dangerous. Mothers taking little kids and babies in those boats. It's just a very strange situation. And then the next day they're on a very luxury ferry to Athens. Same body of water, only a few miles away. So it's very organized. Like the smuggling across the U.S.-Mexico border is very organized as well. You know, on the U.S.-Mexico border, people walk across a very barren and dry desert, and they die of thirst. But the migration into the European Union through Greece happens across a body of water, and people drown. But there's still these very bizarre, brutal tests that people have to pass to immigrate.
The people you spoke with all seemed kind of friendly, and they were blunt about their circumstances, but they still seemed friendly.
Yeah.
Did you get any sense of anger or resentment toward the outside world and that no one was coming to their rescue?
I spoke to some people in a refugee camp in Copenhagen, outside Copenhagen, that were very resentful of having to stay in the camp, and they were denied asylum. So they didn't really know what was going to happen to them. And the camp to them, even though it was a nice place, nice accommodations, it used to be an army base, the food was good, it was still a prison. And so, yeah, there was animosity and some strong feelings from those people. But everybody else, they were sort of just happy to be out alive and to have made the trip. I'm very tired, worn out, and kind of desperate, but they're generally pretty good mood, the better, the farther north they were.
Well, again, listening to this series, you helped me understand who these refugees are and what are their difficult circumstances. But did you get any sense of the people from the countries who are receiving the refugees? I mean, how do they feel?
There's going to be people who are prejudiced, people who are bigots, and people who are open and willing to help. That's going to be the same anywhere in the world, I think. And so Germany and the northern European states, it's the same. Some groups are burning down refugee centers there in Germany. And it's going to be like that anywhere.
Well, okay. The thing that people in the U.S. are concerned about is that kind of embedded in this migration of people are terrorists.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that was a concern of some of the European countries as well.
Yeah.
And what did the people have to say about that, the refugees?
Well, of course they're going to say we're not terrorists. But I think that's actually true. But then you never know. I mean, we don't know even here, our neighbors or people we work with, what they're thinking in their minds. It's the thing about terrorism, you don't know. Yeah, I mean, it was on people's minds. They knew that there were stories and there was a worry about it because I was there right after the big massacre in Paris. One guy said, you know, terrorists wouldn't do this. They would fly. They have money.
Do you have any thoughts about these refugees and if countries were not to welcome them, if we're kind of to leave them in this horrible situation and they didn't reach out and help, what do you think the results of not acting would be, I guess is what I'm trying to say?
Well, they're not leaving their homes because they want a better life. These refugees are leaving their homes because where they live is in a state of war. And so they don't have a choice. They have to leave. If they didn't leave, they'd very likely might be killed. So they're going to keep leaving as long as there's war or a situation similar to war. They'll go somewhere other than to stay at home and get hit by a bomb. And, you know, I mean, if you're looking for something that people should think about, one thing that was never mentioned in any of the stories that I did, and I didn't mention in mine, is that many of these refugees are running away from wars that we started, the United States mainly, with the help of our European allies, of course. And they're running from jihadis who've taken land in their towns and threatening their lives in Afghanistan, Iraq, much of Syria, much of northern Africa. I mean, the exception to that is the Syrians who are running from Assad's army. But almost everybody else I talked to was running from jihadis, holy warriors that have only gotten stronger in number and also their faith since 9/11, since we started the war on terror. And most people don't want to sell all of their possessions to pay smugglers to walk, you know, through the night across foreign countries where they might get arrested and beat up and thrown in jail, or put their babies on boats, rubber boats, to cross the Aegean Sea. People would choose to stay home. And so if we want to think about how to solve the problem, the obvious answer seems to be make it so they don't leave to begin with. They don't want to leave, or they don't have to leave to begin with. And I know, you know, it's difficult because even if we stop fighting war, I don't think our enemies will necessarily. So it's quite a difficult problem at this point.
In watching people stream across the borders, does it make you think differently about a nation's inherent sovereignty and the responsibility towards people outside of its borders?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you can't help but see that stuff and wonder, why don't we just get rid of borders? But then immediately, that's a lot of cognitive dissonance to let into your head to start wondering about getting rid of borders. A lot of things fall apart. You know, like, we make sense. In many ways, we make sense by creating borders, you know, in words and language. And our way of thinking is built upon borders, separations. And to say that they don't exist or we're not going to follow borders anymore is really a way to get a headache pretty quick. So I don't know how to do it. Obviously, borders are artificial. They're created. They're not real. They're not natural. But I don't know if we know how to live without them. I don't know if we understand that yet.
Well, Scott, I'm really grateful that you took the time to speak with me today. And I just want to say that I'm a big fan of what you do and the fact that you're just willing to go out and put a face on people that many of us characterize as just kind of some big nameless, faceless mass.
Right.
And I just am grateful that you do what you do.
Well, thanks, Trey.
That's veteran journalist, or as he prefers to be called, cultural anthropologist, Scott Carrier, speaking about his experience of reporting on the recent refugee migration from the Middle East into Europe. To hear his entire series and other great reporting and insight, visit the Home of the Brave website at homebrave.com. What do you think of the refugee situation? If you're an American, do you fear that terrorists might be among the refugees relocating within our borders? Or do you feel that we should focus on helping those in need, despite the potential risks? Can you let us know on Facebook or on Twitter at Us Them Podcast, or through our feedback page at usandthempodcast.com? Remember, there's no ampersand. You've been listening to Us and Them. This show was produced by Mitch Hanley, Lori Stern, and me, Trey Kay. Michael Lipton and Tristam Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them show music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. Rita Krasoffi and Mariana Trofimova designed our website at usandthempodcast.com and provide us with images for the web. The wonderful people at West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the West Virginia Humanities Council, the CRC Foundation, and now the Daywood Foundation. Our next show will be in time for the Super Bowl. And as of this posting, there's still the possibility that one of the teams will start an African-American quarterback, something that's only happened 3 times in the history of the Super Bowl. It's been 28 years since that barrier was broken.
Breaking the color barrier at quarterback in pro football was maybe the single most important act of desegregation in American sports, because the opposition to blacks playing quarterback was completely tied into the most vile stereotypes that went with notions of white supremacy and black inferiority.
We'll hear from an athlete who played an important role breaking the line in the NFL.
In 1963, when Dr. Martin Luther King made that speech, when he said that one day we'll be judged by the content of our character and not the color of our skin, I often thought it may be a chance that I get a chance to play quarterback in the NFL.
That's next time on Us and Them.
Touchdown!
Oh, and just one more thing. I can't let this opportunity pass without recognizing the passing of David Bowie. He is somebody who certainly has helped inspire me to bridge the gap between us and them. I wish you could swim like dolphins can swim. Though nothing, nothing will keep us together. We can beat them forever.